Thanks, Ken. Well, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I've certainly been to Toronto in the past, but never visited the physics department. And it's fun being around, you know, having conversations with a wide range of people, from quantum optics to condensed matter physics, and it's been really nice. So thanks very much. And certainly one of the things, a big difference between State College in the middle of Pennsylvania and here is the choice of restaurants, which is just terrific. So I gave this slightly provocative title, I guess, Spintronics Without Magnetism, and try to explain what I mean by that. So here's the outline of the talk. I'll first of all just try to give you a very general overview of spintronics and what this buzzword means, and then go on to discuss a couple of different experiments that we've been doing over the last several years in collaboration largely with Dave Avshalom's group at Santa Barbara. And so the students involved in this project are shown, the Penn State students are here, and the Santa Barbara students and postdocs who are doing this work are in the lower panel. They've all moved on to different places since doing these things, some in industry, some as faculty members elsewhere. So the two things I'm going to talk about are how to control spins in semiconductors without magnetic materials by just using the spin-orbit interaction, and secondly by using circularly polarized photons. This is supposed to be a colloquium, so I didn't want to make any assumptions about who would be in the audience, and so I'm going to say a few things that are trivial for most people who know enough physics, and but so forgive me if this is a bit too trivial, but just some reminders that an electron has spin half, so that in a magnetic field you get effectively sort of two energy states up and down, with an energy difference given by the product of the G factor, Bohr magneton, and magnetic field. And in free electrons, you know, we know that the G factor is 2. But in solid state systems, you can of course make these G factors very different depending on the band structure. Another aspect that one needs to be aware of is that you can study the dynamics of electron spin states, and you can define a relaxation time T1, which is essentially the relaxation time to go from the high energy state to the low energy state, or you can imagine creating superpositions of spin up and spin down states, in which case one can talk about a T2 or a dephasing time. Now, when we first learn about quantum mechanics, we start off with a non-relativistic Schrodinger equation, essentially, which is spinless. But then we, of course, know that later on one realized that by taking into account relativistic effects, that one could see that there's a spin orbit coupling also that comes into the picture. And I'll show you that it's this spin orbit coupling that one can try to exploit in spintronics when you're trying to do spintronics without any magnetism at all, or without magnetic materials. Now, to start out with, let me start right at the beginning. So, you know, what exactly does this mean? You know that the sociology of science is always a troublesome thing. You know, every few years, people think of some clever way to sell an idea, and you have to come up with a buzzword. And so, what exactly is spintronics? Well, first of all, I'll make this a multiple choice test. You know, since I teach these large classes with, and not in the last year, but before that, I've always been teaching these freshman classes with 900 students or thereabouts, and you know, we make these multiple choice exams. So this is a terrible set of answers, because it should be quite obvious what the answer is. But anyway, here are some choices. It's an acronym for spin transport based electronics. It's a misnomer for a commonly used technology. It's a potentially exciting path towards processing and storing classical and or quantum information in solid-state devices in the distant future. Now, if you remove the distant future, this is probably the statement of many introductory paragraphs in proposals. And then, next, a convenient excuse for funding your favorite condensed matter physics project, which you never put into a proposal. Or is it all of the above? So what do you think the answer is? It's all of the above, right. So to begin with, the word spintronics was coined, so that everyone knows in this room, by a program manager. He was a program manager, Stu Wolf, at DARPA, who was an extremely successful program manager in that agency. And he realized, of course, that to be a successful program manager, you always have to convince the admirals and the brass and the DOD about what you're trying to do with your science and technology. And spintronics was a very convenient acronym for spin transport based electronics. And he applied it in, this is why I call it a misnomer, really to the work being done at IBM and at other places in fabricating magnetic field sensors that were based on the discovery of giant magnetoresistance. And so this discovery of giant magnetoresistance is a very simple phenomenon to explain to you in words, but underlying it is, of course, a great deal of interesting quantum mechanics and analysis, and this was what received the Nobel Prize in 2007. And the basic idea is that if you have two ferromagnetic metals, which form a trilayer sandwich with a non-magnetic metal in between, so this entire object is conducting, but these two layers are ferromagnets, then if you measure the resistance of this device, then that resistance is high when these two ferromagnets are anti-aligned with each other, and it's low when these two are aligned parallel with each other. And this effect is large enough at room temperature that once it was published in PhysRev Letters by Albert Fert, it rapidly made its way into, towards technology, and IBM was able to successfully make micro drives using this reed head sensor. Incidentally, a lesson to students, when this discovery was made in parallel by Albert Fert and Grunberg, Fert, of course, published it in PRL, and Grunberg took out a patent. So anyway, before he published it. And he sold it later on to IBM. There is another form of magnetoresistance, which these days is very commonly found in your hard drive, and that's tunneling magnetoresistance. So if you replace this middle layer, instead of a conducting metal, you make it into an insulator, then you have a tunneling device in which the tunneling resistance is low when the two ferromagnets are pointing parallel, and it's a high resistance when they're anti-parallel. So the next time you're teaching a modern physics class, you don't have to use alpha decay as an example of tunneling. You can actually ask them to rip open their hard drives, and there is a quantum device that we all use all the time. But clearly, I mean, this term, spintronics, spin transport-based electronics, somehow does not correctly describe the principle. Magnetic reed heads or magnetic field sensors are not necessarily in the spirit of the connotation of spintronics. What one would like to do is develop a technology based on spin where you can sort of do, the equivalent of what we do with electronic devices, where you can do some kind of information processing or build, build a circuit or something like that. And so several of us about a decade or so ago decided that, well, we should start doing this with semiconductors. And the vague idea we had at that time was that can we, as fundamental objectives, have the idea that we want to control spins? They might be band electrons, magnetic ions, or nuclei in semiconductors. And we saw this as a challenge and somewhat of an opportunity. And the big challenge that still remains, as I'll try to make clear, is how do you go from something that you do understand, basic physics, where you can carry out nice whether optical experiments or transport experiments, and transition that to something that you would never dare to show to your EE colleagues. Some vague idea of some kind of a chip that does everything from memory storage to logic to communications based upon spin. And what I would like to argue with you is that, yes, this is a challenging and interesting area for doing fundamental devices, for fundamental physics, and there are interesting ideas for devices, but there's still a long way to go towards making this into a real technology. So what are the ideas that have been around for semiconductor spintronic devices? Well, one of the very seminal ideas was advanced by a couple of electrical engineers at Purdue University, Shupriyo Datta and Biswajit Das, and they proposed a very clever idea. They said that instead of making a field effect transistor using just standard semiconductor materials and metals as source and drain contacts, imagine that you replace the source and the drain by ferromagnets, and you choose a semiconductor in which there is a strong spin-orbit interaction, okay? So if you now inject a spin-polarized spin current into this channel, then if you apply an electric field using a capacitative gate over here, then that electric field effectively in the reference frame of the electrons looks like a magnetic field because of the spin-orbit interaction, and the electrons can precess. So if these electrons now precess and then reach this other contact over here, depending on the spin direction, the device is either on or off. So it's a very clever idea. You have to realize that Shupriyo Datta, who's a very, you know, serious device physics guy, never used the word that this was a spin-based field effect transistor. He very modestly called it an electronic analog of the electro-optical modulator. But the rest of the field jumped on this and made this into the poster child for spintronics and said that, well, let's all go and make this device. No one actually ever asked the question, is this faster or more efficient than current or even projected CMOS technology? But one certainly felt, with some justification, that since all you are doing is switching the direction of a spin, that intuitively you might have a gut-level feeling that, yes, you know, this is likely to be a lower power or something like that. But there was no detailed analysis of anything of that kind, and certainly Das and Datta did not claim to be making such a device. Now, how far along are we towards making these devices? It turns out that even though the concept itself looks relatively simple, making it into reality has taken quite a long time. And in fact, we're still not completely there. We don't have a demonstration of the complete spin-fed device. It took about, 15 years or something like that to solve simply, 10 years to solve simply one stage of the problem, which was to take a ferromagnetic metal and figure out how to inject a spin-polarized current from that metal into the semiconductor. And there's a very simple way to look at it if you use an argument from Mott from many years ago. And the argument of Mott is simply the following, that in a ferromagnetic metal, imagine that you have two channels of transport which occur in parallel, one for spin up, one for spin down, and ignore any kind of relaxation process between the two, okay? So now imagine that when you make a ferromagnetic metal contact with a semiconductor, you can envision this as a circuit of parallel resistors. There is a resistor for the ferromagnetic metal with spin up, then there is a resistor for the semiconductor for the spin up channel, then there's a resistor for the spin down in the metal, and a resistor for the spin down in the semiconductor. Now clearly, the conductivity of the semiconductor is much lower than that of the metal. And so this parallel circuit is going to be dominated by the large resistors in your semiconductor. And so no matter what you do in this metal, the current in both of these, the spin current, is going to be the same. And so it's very difficult to spin inject. It seemed like an impossible problem. But it was solved by using tunnel barriers at these interfaces. And I won't go into the details of that. The bottom line is that now some very nice experiments done by Paul Kroll at Minnesota, Barry Yonker at Naval Research Lab, and other people elsewhere, have clearly shown that you can take ferromagnetic contacts, you can drive a current, a spin-polarized current, through the semiconductor, and you can detect a voltage, or you can detect the presence of a spin current using some special schemes that, you know, I won't describe in detail. What I would just like to point out to you is that these voltage versus magnetic field graphs essentially prove that you can spin inject from this ferromagnetic metal into the semiconductor, so that when these two contacts have parallel states, you see a small voltage. When they have anti-parallel states, you see a large voltage. Okay? So that much is done, but we don't know how to precess the spins yet in that particular device, and the whole package is not still here. Now, one of the questions that I raised on a couple of slides ago is, you know, is a very legitimate question that any device engineer would ask you. If you want me to build a fab where you want me to replace CMOS technology with your nice brand new spintronics, am I really going to spend $1 billion doing this? You know, and why should I do it? And so the question is, does the performance of spin-based semiconductor devices potentially warrant the effort? And this question only has started being addressed recently in the last few years, And one of the seminal papers for that is a proposal by Kimberly Hall, or analysis by Kimberly Hall and Michael Flatte, showing that in a standard, the difference between a standard FET and a spin-based FET is that in a standard FET, you actually have to raise and lower a barrier height. You have to change a barrier in order to turn that device on and off. Whereas you can come up with schemes in spin-based FETs such that you make that barrier spin sensitive. So imagine over here that this green is a barrier for the green electrons, but it's not a barrier for blue electrons, and the blue and green refer to opposite spins. So simply by changing the spin polarization over here without necessarily having to raise and lower the barrier, you can turn the device on and off. And their analysis does at least initiate a debate, a serious debate about whether this is a useful approach. And their argument is that, yes, it is. Now, one of the unusual things that you can do with spintronics, with semiconductors, is the following. I told you that the word spintronics was invented for metallic ferromagnetic-based devices. If I give you a piece of iron, the ferromagnetism in the piece of iron is essentially fixed. I can't take some external technique like applying an electric field or something like that to change the magnetic properties of the material. Imagine now instead of using a metal, I use a semiconductor, and I introduce magnetic ions into the semiconductor. So I make something called a magnetic semiconductor, something that is a ferromagnet, but it's at the same time has a semiconductor band structure. Now, in many of these semiconductors, the ones that we actually understand, this ferromagnetism is mediated between the magnetic moments by the presence of a Fermi sea, or by electrons or holes somewhere in the conduction or valence band or an impurity band or something like that. And Ken over here, Ken Birch, has made an enormous impact in this field by looking at one of these particular materials, manganese-doped gallium arsenide, and showing that by using infrared conductivity, you can really raise questions about theoretical models that people are trying to put forward to explain some of these materials. But regardless of the details, the point is that in a semiconductor, you can control the ferromagnetic interaction by varying the carrier density in the semiconductor. Now, what this means is that you can take a device in which you have, let's say, under standard conditions, you have a system which shows a hysteresis loop in the magnetization. This magnetization is measured by using transport techniques, but nonetheless, it is the magnetization. And it shows you a hysteresis loop, which is what you get when you have a ferromagnet. Now, you apply a voltage across this device, and you change the carrier density. And look what happens. If you increase the number of carriers, you get a much more robust magnetic signal. So you've made this into a stronger ferromagnet. If you take away carriers, so you apply a voltage in the opposite direction, you completely quench the ferromagnetism. So this is work that was done by Hideo Ono's group in Tohoku University. And it shows you the power of magnetism in semiconductors, that you can turn magnetism on and off by using an electric field. One of the things that we have explored in recent years is, just like in that earlier slide where I showed you that you can change the static magnetic state of a ferromagnet by using an electric field, we wondered, can you actually change the dynamical aspects of the magnetism by using electric fields? And so for this, we decided to explore a system which we call parabolic magnetic quantum wells. So we make these systems by a growth technique called molecular beam epitaxy. It's essentially a very expensive version of doing evaporation. So you take, you basically have ultra-high vacuum, and you evaporate elemental from elemental sources. You evaporate a beam of atoms. You impinge them on the substrate, and you can essentially play atomic scale Lego. So you can define any kind of potential that you want. And what we are able to do is we can define a parabolic shape for the potential that's seen by band electrons in the semiconductor. And then right in the middle of this parabolic potential, we position magnetic ions, okay? So there are local moments, d electrons. There are s electrons or p electrons in the conduction band and the valence band. There is an exchange interaction between these. whenever there is this exchange interaction, you get a large Zeeman splitting. It's an exchange-enhanced Zeeman splitting. And what you can now do is that you apply an electric field to this. So, well, you know, you all know, you can all think about this very easily. This is a parabolic potential. You add to the parabolic potential a linear term, so something that's linear in distance, and that's essentially a parabola with its minimum displaced, right? So, so what you're doing is that when you apply an electric field, you shift the place where the wave function, the ground state wave function, is going to be localized. And so you change the overlap between these magnetic ions and the electronic states. And then you try to look at the dynamics of this system. And the way you look at the dynamics is by doing a pump probe experiment that that we carry out in Dave Avshalom's group at Santa Barbara. And these are measurements that were done by Roberto Myers, who was a student of David's and is now a faculty member at Ohio State. And the idea of this is quite easy to understand. You take circularly polarized light, right? And you have the circularly polarized light incident on the sample. Because of electric dipole selection rules, you transfer the momentum from the circularly polarized light, the spin from the circularly polarized light, to the spin of electrons in this system. And so you create some spin polarized electrons, and you apply a magnetic field, which I think I forgot to show here, which is applied in plane to the sample, that causes these electrons to precess around the magnetic field. You then come in with a time-delayed linearly polarized beam, and you measure its Faraday rotation. So the degree of rotation of that linear polarization gives you the component of the electron spins along this initial direction. And as a function of the pump probe time delay, you essentially map out the dynamics of the spins in the system. So you can do this in these parabolic quantum wells as a function of the electric field. So in other words, as you change the overlap between the confined wave functions and the magnetic ions. And here's what you see. This color map over here shows you the intensity of the Faraday rotation as a function of time and as a function of the DC bias voltage. And you can see via the changes in color over here that what you're seeing are oscillations, right? And the oscillations over here at zero bias are in the terahertz range. As you increase the electric field, what you find is that these oscillations now occur at the gigahertz range. So in other words, by applying an electric field, you're able to change the spin dynamics going on with the electrons, the coherent spin precession of the electrons over an order of magnitude in frequency range. And not only that, you also see this other precession in the background over here. It turns out that that precession is the spin precession of the magnetic ions themselves. They're G equal to two magnetic ions, the S equal to five halves systems, but they're described by a G factor of two, and that is essentially the precession of those magnetic ions. And if you look carefully, you find that the electric field even modifies the precession of the magnetic ions. So it's a very powerful demonstration that by magnetically doping semiconductors, that you can use electric fields in clever ways to modify static magnetization and dynamic magnetization. So far, everything has dealt with trying to do spintronics or spin-dependent phenomena in semiconductors using magnetic ions somewhere. You use them either to inject into the material or to put them inside the material to create large spin-dependent effects. So the materials that one uses for these are a range of very simple materials. They're not exotic. They're just based upon standard optoelectronic materials such as zinc selenide, gallium arsenide, very well understood, very simple lattices. And we can actually go into my clean room and fabricate all sorts of interesting things with these materials because we know how to deal with them. So, it's a very well-defined set of systems that one can play with. So now that I've convinced you, I hope that there is interesting stuff to be done in conventional spintronics with magnetic materials. How do you do this without magnetism? Well, the first idea, you always think about, I've got a great idea, and you realize, oh no, someone thought about it in 1920. Well, if you think about the idea of spin orbit coupling and how it influences scattering, The genesis of this idea is really by in a calculation by Mott when he looked at scattering of electrons by atomic nuclei in the presence of spin orbit coupling. So he basically used the Dirac equation and showed that when you have Coulomb scattering, the angle of scattering depends on the spin. So the idea then is that can we use this in semiconductors? Now, remember that in the vacuum, the spin orbit coupling constant is given by this combination of constants, and in the units that I have over here, it's if something of this magnitude, like that 3.7 times 10 to the minus 8. But when you make a crystal, when you make a semiconductor crystal or any solid state crystal, the spin orbit, the form of the spin orbit interaction is related to then parameters of the band structure. And if you now calculate what is the effective lambda and compare it with this, you find that that lambda is much larger. And so you can really hope to see interesting effects in semiconductors by using this spin orbit coupling, right? It's many orders of magnitude larger than in a free atom. So how can you do this? Well, let's see. We're going to focus on two materials. We're going to focus on gallium arsenide and zinc selenide. And the first effect I'm going to talk about is something called the spin Hall effect. So the idea here is that imagine that you have, you know, a semiconductor in which you have this spin orbit coupling term. And you take the idea of Mott that you're going to get some spin-dependent scattering angle if you just flow an ordinary current through this ordinary semiconductor. So we're not going to do anything special in terms of materials. You just use standard old gallium arsenide, which is the semiconductor that gives this red light in this laser, and you flow a current through it. And when you flow a current through this system, in the absence of any magnetic field, no magnetic materials, what was predicted by Dyakonov and Perel many years ago was that this should happen. As the current flows, you should get spin up electrons going to one side, spin down electrons going to the other side. So imagine that, you know, this is some two-dimensional system and you're breaking the symmetry that way, right? Dave Afshalom's group went after this project, went after this experiment several years ago, where this was an experiment done by Yuichiro Kato. And David has this talent of devising experiments where rather than trying to interpret data in complicated ways, he just wants to see the result. He wants to see the, you know, the phenomenon. And Yuichiro Kato developed this very nice imaging technique where you just take linearly polarized light, reflect it off the sample, and then you measure the rotation of that light. And you scan across your sample. This took him quite a lot of time to do because these signals are small. But as you can see here, you flow a current through this, and you get the signal dividing, you know, the spin up and spin down electrons separating across the channel. The image on this side is the ordinary reflectivity without any polarization resolution, so just to show that there are no artifacts arising from something unusual, you know, some unusual artifact due to, let's say, some asymmetry between the two sides of the sample. There's nothing like that. This is purely related to the separation of the spins. And it's a DC effect. I mean, you can just, run this DC current and you can create this image. So the question now is, how large are these signals? Well, it turns out that the Faraday rotations represented by these maxima over here are relatively small. You know, they're of the order of, they're certainly in the sometimes milliradians or thereabouts. And so one would like to figure out what is actually responsible for this spin Hall effect. And you can try to map it out. You can try to map it out in great detail by doing measurements such as the Hanley effect, in which you apply a magnetic field in this direction, right? So when you apply a magnetic field in this direction, you essentially start precessing the spins around the magnetic field, and that creates a depolarization. So as you change the magnetic field and you measure, let's say, the Kerr rotation at one particular spot, you can get a Lorentzian curve, and from this Lorentzian curve, you can deduce things like the spin relaxation time, and from that, by combining things with the diffusion analysis of the spatial profile, you can extract parameters related to the spin Hall effect. And one of those parameters is called the spin Hall conductivity. So it turns out that this spin Hall conductivity has been calculated by Bert Halperin's group by using a spin-dependent Boltzmann approach, and they're able to relate the spin Hall conductivity to parameters of the material. And one of the important parameters is the spin orbit coupling constant. So one question we decided to ask was, well, can we go to materials where the spin orbit coupling constant is much weaker than in gallium arsenide? So in some sense, trying to convince a graduate student, why don't you go and do an experiment where you expect to see nothing? And of course, this is a hard experiment, so it took some convincing. But fortunately, Nate Stern decided to do this experiment. And surprisingly, he takes a material such as zinc selenide, which we grow in my MBE chamber, and we dope it with donors at particular levels, and there's no point going into the details of that in a colloquium, but we know that this is a system with 5 times weaker spin orbit coupling than in gallium arsenide, and you do this, for example, this Hanley effect measurement or the mapping, spatial mapping, and so on, and surprisingly, you find, you know, a spin Hall effect. Not only do you see a spin Hall effect, it turns out that the spin Hall conductivity that I mentioned is comparable to that of gallium arsenide. And not only that, in gallium arsenide, the effect disappears at about roughly 100 and odd Kelvin. Here in zinc selenide, the effect persists up to room temperature. So, you know, this is one of these puzzles that you manage to get published because it is such an unusual result, but you really have to scratch your head and say, you know, what's going on here? You know, if I'm reducing the spin orbit coupling constant, why am I seeing this spin Hall conductivity, which is similar to gallium arsenide? Why is it that I'm seeing this up to room temperature? Well, we don't know the answers to all these questions yet. We do know some of the answers. And one of the answers is actually provided by this Engel, Halperin, and Rajpa theory, which calculates the spin Hall conductivity to lowest order in the spin orbit coupling interaction and 1 over kf times le, where kf is the wave vector and LE, the Fermi wave vector, and LE is the elastic scattering mean free path, right? And it turns out that in this perturbative calculation, if you look at it carefully, you find that the small parameter that controls the polarization of the scattered carriers is related to the spin orbit coupling constant, and it's also related to parameters which you can put together in terms of a sort of a Bohr radius for the carriers in the semiconductor, for the electrons in the semiconductor. So it involves the effective mass, the dielectric constant, and things like that, right? And it just so happens that coincidentally in zinc selenide, yes, we have reduced this lambda by a factor of 5, but it also turns out that because we have gone to a wider band gap material, we have changed the effective mass in such a way that this small parameter remains roughly the same. And at least this is my take on this calculation, and we haven't seen this, you know, analyzed in any detail by Halperin's group yet. But it certainly raises the question that you don't necessarily have to look at spin Hall effect type phenomena in systems with large spin orbit coupling. You can go to weak spin orbit coupling. You have to look at the overall problem, you know, in a fuller way, and you can get surprises. The one question we still don't have an answer to is, why do we see this effect at room temperature, whereas in gallium arsenide, it quits at lower temperatures? And that's an answer that we're still seeking. Now, in the last, 5-10 minutes or so, I want to go on to describe another way in which you can look at spintronics without magnetism. And this, again, was a project that that we sort of stumbled upon in some sense. And the idea was, can we use these pump probe spin dynamics techniques that we've been using for semiconductors with David's group, can we use these things to look at the coupling between confined photons? You put photons into a resonant cavity, and you look at the coupling between these photons and optically excited spin polarized electron states. And again, just to quickly go through this, the idea is that you come in with circularly polarized light in the presence of a magnetic field which is transverse to that, and you create a coherent superposition, and then you do a time delayed measurement of the Faraday rotation, and as a function of time, you get this precessing signal. And effectively, what you're measuring here is not a dephasing time T2, but a T2 star, because it's an inhomogeneous spin lifetime, right? You're making a large ensemble of these spins. And relevant sort of relaxation times are the whole spins we know relax very fast. But the electron spins can survive for reasonable amounts of time, okay? Now, I won't go through this slide because I want to just cut to the chase. So the idea here was something that we came up with on a purely intuitive basis without any serious calculation. I was going to say serious thought, but that's not true, but serious calculation. And the idea was simple. We know that in atomic physics, we know that there's the effect called the Purcell effect, that you can change the spontaneous emission lifetime of some kind of emitter by putting it into a cavity, by confining the photons. And purely on an intuitive level, we asked ourselves the question, well, is it possible that you can somehow affect spin lifetimes if you have a coupled state between photons and electrons? Not to say that we are making strongly coupled states. It is just a very intuitive thought. And so the idea was that let's start making microcavity lasers or microcavities with semiconductors and try to look at spin dynamics in these things. So I put a student onto this project, and this is not something that we invented. This had been around in Bell Labs and other places 10 years before, but we certainly figured out how to make very nice microcavities in the clean room. So this object here has a diameter of about 1 micron, and it's made from a monolithic chip. So you start with a wafer, and you use clever chemical machining techniques to get to something that looks like this. And not only do you make this, but when you make the structure, right in the optically active region of the structure, you purposely make rough interfaces which act like quantum dots. In other words, when you excite electronic states, they are like electron states in a box, okay? And you can see these electronic states in a box by going in and doing spatially resolved spectroscopy, and instead of having a broad emission line, you start seeing these very sharp resolution-limited lines in the emission spectra. So now, you try and develop an understanding of these microdisc lasers, and we've done all that. We've done all the standard spectroscopy of these systems in my lab, and we found that, you can make very nice lasers. You can see the presence of these what I call quantum dots. You can get these lasers to show stimulated emission. This is just the emission spectrum as you go beyond threshold and you start seeing the laser starting to emit very nicely. You can study the what the laser threshold is as a function of the geometry and so on. And you can then start really improving the qualities of these systems. And we've been able to make lasers that have very low thresholds, something like 150 nanowatts. And if you plot, for example, the laser emission as a function of the power, you can get to regimes where you almost don't see a threshold. These are very nicely efficient lasers. So now, once you start doing this, you have students who do go crazy and spending time in the clean room. And this guy was incredibly talented, and he's been able to develop all sorts of beautiful structures like this. So instead of dealing with just a single disk, you can couple them together. You can see sort of evanescent mode coupling between the disks so that you get the equivalent of bonding and anti-bonding mode, modes in quotes. You can make lasers with little micromagnets on top of them and all that, So we really have good control in fabricating these systems. So now along comes this experiment where we have no theoretical basis except for this very intuitive idea. And we approached Sai Ghosh, who was Dave Afshalom's postdoc at the time, with this idea. And, Sai was game and jumped into this project right away. And she did these measurements of pump probe Kerr rotation on single microdisks. So these microdisks are made with 100 micron spacings between them. And, you just go and measure the Kerr rotation, time-resolved Kerr rotation on a single microdisk. And this is one of these microdisk lasers where you go and pump and probe, for example, at that emission wavelength. And you notice that if you look at the dephasing of the electrons, optically excited electrons in these systems, you see that as you change the intensity with which you're pumping, there is a non-monotonic dependence of this decay time on the pump intensity. And you can do this now as a function of wavelength and as a function of power and so on, and focus your attention on this graph over here. What this is showing is the T2 star on a color scale as a function of the wavelength at which you are doing the measurement and pumping, and as a function of the power with which you are pumping. Red corresponds to a long spin lifetime. Blue corresponds to a short spin lifetime. And you see that there is a sweet spot in this data. So when you pump the microdisc resonantly with what's known as a whispering gallery mode, you know, a resonant mode of the cavity, you get an enhancement of the T2 star. When you change the power at a fixed wavelength, you find that the T2 star increases, you know, markedly. And we see this in many, many of these cavities. It increases markedly right at the transparency threshold of the laser. And we've mapped this out very systematically in many different samples, and we clearly see this behavior. And of course, the problem with going with an intuitive idea like this is that you can get a lot of systematic data, which Cy did, and but we still don't have an explanation for this. So it's data that I love to talk about because I really think that there is some systematics there that can be understood, but we still don't have a picture that tells us why this phenomenon should be happening. We've of course done a study with control samples in which you look at the T2 star as a function of pump power in samples that are not in a microdisc, so that's the black data over here, in samples which are microdiscs but which do not have any quantum dots in them. And so the key message is that when do we get this enhancement effect? We get it when we have a micro resonator. We get it when we are resonantly pumping into a resonant mode of that resonator. We get it only if we have quantum dots. So we have this strongly confining potential for the electrons that we are exciting, and we don't get it otherwise, right? And it has to be right at that. You have to be right at the transparency threshold of that laser. So this is one example of how, you know, you can start looking at spin-dependent phenomena in semiconductors without having any magnetism at all, just by using circularly polarized light and following your intuition into directions where there are not necessarily any theoretical guidelines. So I hope that I've been able to give you, you know, a broad snapshot at least of what's going on in this field. And I've told you that spintronics really is a term that should be applied to making devices that depend on spin, but with semiconductors, because that's where I think you can hope to do something that sounds like spintronics at least. But we don't quite know how to get there. There are ideas for devices. It's not clear that these ideas are necessarily going to provide a convincing way to go to the semiconductor industry and say that, well, you should abandon everything, and by the year 2018, we'll have something that's competitive, you know, with your current projections, even though there are arguments, you know, being advanced about that. I've tried to show you that, well, you can do spin control in magnetic semiconductors. So you sort of go from ferromagnetic metals to magnetic semiconductors, and you can carry over some ideas, but there are new things you can do with a semiconductor. You can change the magnetism by using a battery. You can't do that with a piece of iron or permalloy, right? But I've also shown you that you can do spin control without magnetism, where all you need is spin orbit coupling, and sometimes you can do surprising things with, confining photons in micro cavities and so on. So if anyone wants to learn more about ongoing activities in this field, I'd be more than happy to chat with them. But thanks very much for the attention.